Hello, good morning. My name is Miguel Duarte Barroso. I am a senior software developer working for Red Hat on the networking team of our downstream distribution of Kubevert. For those of you that are not aware, Kubevert is a virtualization plugin for Kubernetes that allows the user to run a virtual machine within a Kubernetes pod. I'm here today to present privilege dropping one capability at a time on the virtualization and infrastructure as a service dev room at FOSDEM 2021. In this talk, we will explain what Linux capabilities are, how they improve security, and especially how we have refactored Kubevert's code to reduce the overall attack surface, thus effectively making our virtualization solution more secure. You can find my email address along with my GitHub profile link in the bottom left. You can contact me via those. Without further ado, let us proceed to the agenda. We will begin with an introduction about Linux capabilities, where I will explain what they are and how the kernel uses them. I will furthermore perform a small demo about those, which will hopefully make it all easier to understand. Once we have a common understanding about Linux capabilities, I will briefly explain the Kubevert architecture, focusing on how security is segmented in its process model and how networking is configured for virtual machines running in it. With these pieces, knowledge about capabilities, and a minimal knowledge about networking configuration within Kubevert, I will then proceed into explaining our motivation for the work behind this presentation, along with its problem statement, and ultimately the goals of the development work predating this talk. We will then explain the considerations we've had and how the code was refactored to allow dropping the capabilities. We will then conclude the talk with a list of next steps, since there are a few nits left behind yet to be addressed. Let's finally begin the presentation by moving into the introduction section. When evaluating permission checks in Linux, there are two categories of processes: privileged, owned by superuser, effective user ID 0, and unprivileged, literally everyone else. A privileged process bypasses all kernel permission checks, whereas an unprivileged one is subject to full permission checking based on the caller's credentials, effective user ID and group ID, and also further group membership. This sounds and is a one-size-fits-all solution. Take the ping command, for example. A while back, it had to be granted full privileged access so it could bind to a raw socket. An attacker, if he could exploit the ping command and succeeded in compromising it, would have unlimited access to the system. Such capabilities were introduced in kernel 2.2. The privileged kernel calls were split into groups of related functionality that can be independently enabled or disabled on a per-thread basis. If you need to bind to a raw socket, you shouldn't need to be super user for that. After this refactor, you would use the net raw capability instead. If you need to create or configure a bridge, or a VEF pair, or any other virtual interface type, you would require the netadmin capability instead of being superuser. With this improved model, if an attacker manages to successfully compromise a piece of the system, he does just that, compromises a piece of the system, instead of being granted unlimited access to it. On this talk, I'll focus on the two network-related capabilities that Kubevert is using, capability netraw and capability netadmin. I will now perform a short demo, where we will see what groups of privileged calls are controlled by each of the aforementioned capabilities. You can find the detailed guides in the repository mentioned in this slide. Let's begin by demoing the group of calls that require the netadmin capability. For this, we will require two shells. In the one above, we will run a Docker container based on the CentOS 8 image that does feature the netadmin capability. we will execute the bash command in it because we will be interacting directly with the container. In the shell below, on the other hand, we will execute the exact same thing with the difference that we will not load the netadmin capability into the container. We will now create a bridge on the container that features the netadmin capability. As we can see, creating the bridge was possible, and we have our BR0 bridge within the container. We will now replicate the experiment on the container that does not feature the netadmin capability. And we can see that we got an error back. The operation is not permitted. We are missing the required permissions, in this case, the netadmin capability, to perform this operation. The same would happen for every other type of virtual interface. For instance, if you created a tap device, the results would have been the same. For a VETH pair, exactly the same. You would need this capability in order to create those. Let us now try to configure an existing interface instead. For instance, we will try and configure the MAC address of the Ethernet 0. As we can see, it succeeded on the container that features the capability. Let's try in the one that does not have it. And as we can see, it failed. This means that configuring an existing interface also requires this capability. The same would have happened if we updated the MTU instead or any other sort of parameter. In this part of the demo, we'll showcase how the NetRock capability impacts network operations. For it, we will create two containers. The first will feature the NetRock capability and the other will not have it. Then we will try to create a raw socket. For this, we will use a custom image that you can build from the repository previously mentioned in the presentation. It features a simple Golang program that attempts to create and configure different types of sockets. For our first experiment, we must ensure that the NetRock capability is not present on the container. For that, we use the capdrop option of Docker. We will run the capabilities demo image, which is generated from the repository that I've linked on the presentation. Let's now check the CLI parameters on the image. Capraw, okay, I've made a typo here. It's netraw instead of capraw. And the command that we will be using is the raw socket. This will request a raw socket and we'll bind it to an address that features the Ethernet 0 zone. And as we can see, since we do not have the NetRock capability, since we're dropping it, we get an operation not permitted error. Let's now replicate this experiment, but instead of dropping the capability, ensuring that it is present by using cap add. As we can see, it succeeded. We managed to create a raw socket on the interface Ethernet bound to the Ethernet 0 zone. You can check the code for this on the repository as well. Let us now move to the second NetRaw example where we do something different. Instead of opening a raw socket, we open a datagram socket and set the bind to device socket option on the datagram socket. For that, we will use the same image as before, this time with the bind to device command. It also receives a parameter. We will still use the Ethernet 0 interface as our guinea pig. And in the scenario, we are adding the NetRock capability, so I expect this to work. As we can see, we succeeded in creating a datagram socket. We managed to bind it to the device Ethernet 0 via the bind to device socket option, and we bound it to the 547 port. Let us now do the exact same thing, but this time ensuring the capability is not present. As we see, we got an error back. We cannot bind to the interface without the CAPNET raw or root permissions. You can see the code for this short demo in the repository I've linked before, and in fact I encourage you to do so. I will finalize this section with a few examples of attacks that would be possible by exploiting these capabilities, and we'll follow up with a demo of one of them. With NetAdmin, you could leak the HTTP replies from the pod or container to the host, thus effectively reconfiguring the host's networks. With it, you could install a new default route in the system or a new DNS server. This would result in taking over address or DNS resolution. With NetRaw, you are granted the ability to craft raw packets, like ARP and DNS, which give a malicious user ample room to play with network-related attacks. An attacker could spoof the identity of a default gateway, thus replacing it with a gateway under his or her control. The same can be applied to DNS, which means that NetRaw can also be exploited to take over address or DNS resolution from the host. In order to demo this attack, we will need first to create a VETH pair in the host's network namespace. It will be called Sneaky VETH. Its type will be VETH, obviously, and its peer name will be sneakyveth-br, so we can easily identify which end of the VETH is to be connected to the Docker Zero bridge. We will then connect the sneakyveth-br end of the VETH pair to the Docker Zero bridge in the host's namespace. And also set both sides of the VETH pair to the up state. As we can see, we have both the sides of the VETH pair, one connected to the Docker Zero bridge, and both of them in the up state. One thing left to do, let's take a brief look at our routing table, particularly at the default routes. There's a single one installed. And let's check connectivity to a well-known address, let's say redhat.com. It works, we are connected to the internet. Let us now start a TMUX session and start our DHCP server. Its name will be DHCP server. Let's not invent much here. It does require the NetAdmin capability, as we've been discussing this throughout this time. We need to pull it from the correct registry because we are again using our custom built image that you can find available on the repo. And let's call the capabilities demo binary with the start DHCP server argument. Bind that the DHCP server to the Ethernet Zero interface. Let's advertise this CIDR, the 10.10.10.2/24. The IP server will be in the same subnet but with the .1 address. And here in the router, this will be what we will advertise as a default route. Let's just put some garbage in and specify a weirdly enough MTU. We're now pulling the container image and we have started the DHCP server. Now let us look at our interfaces again and start an instance of DH client on our sneaky VETH end of the VETH pair. Okay. We can see that we got a reply. We got these logs on the DHCP server shell. We were offered an IP address. We are now bound to the .2 IP address, which is the CIDR that we advertised. We can now see the IP address that we were offered from the server, and we can also see the MTU that we advertised. Let's take a look at default routes, and we can see that we have now two new default routes. The one that I called garbage before. And let's take a look. Let's ping the same well-known address, and we see that our networking is broken. Basically, because we have configured a default route with a lower metric. Now that we have a basic understanding about Linux capabilities, let us focus on the kubevirt architecture. Kubevirt is a virtualization plugin for Kubernetes and follows its declarative philosophy. When a set of specifications are posted to the Kubernetes API server, they are then transformed into an internal object of a specific type. After that, a specific controller that has previously registered itself as that type's handler will push all the buttons required to make that request happen. For instance, once a new pod object is seen internally, the respective controllers perform the necessary actions to bring the pod alive and match the required state. Kubevirt delivers three things to provide the new functionality. The first, additional virtualization related types, known by custom resource definitions in Kubernetes lingo, that will extend the existing API. The second, additional controllers for cluster-wide logic associated with these new types. And finally, additional daemons for no specific logic associated with the new types. An example task is mounting the KVM device required by QEMU into the pods that will hold the user's VM. The kubevirt process model is simple. There is a virtualization controller that specifies the pod where the VM will run, a process called virthandler, which operates as kubevirt's agent in each of the nodes, and finally, a virtlauncher process that will encapsulate the libvirt and QEMU processes that will run the user's virtual machine. On this talk, I will be focusing on virthandler, again, kubevirt's agent, and in virtlauncher, which encapsulates the user's VM. Virthandler is a trusted component of kubevirt. It runs on a privileged daemon set and is responsible for creating and configuring any required infrastructure for the pod encapsulating the VM. Virtlauncher process, on the other hand, is an untrusted component of kubevirt, since it wraps the libvirt process that will run third-party workloads. As a result, it must be executed with as little privileges as required. Throughout the remainder of the presentation, I will be referring to these two processes by trusted and untrusted components. Keep in mind that the former refers to virthandler, while the latter refers to virtlauncher. Configuring networking for a virtual machine is, in its essence, composed of two different operations. To perform those, kubevirt introduced the bind mechanism concept. Bind mechanism is something that binds the pod interface to the virtual machine interface. Its first task is how to extend the networking that Kubernetes delivers for the pod into the virtual machine that will be spawned. Let's see how that is done. I am a firm believer that it is easier to understand something when given an example. So let's imagine we want to create a virtual machine having two different interfaces. When the pod is created, Kubernetes agent in the node invokes the corresponding CNI plugins, which are responsible for creating and configuring a network interface in the newly created pod. If we recall our example, we requested two interfaces. It is part of CNI's responsibility to create these interfaces in our pod. The bind mechanisms will then kick in and create all sorts of auxiliary networking infrastructure to extend networking from the pod interface into what will be our virtual machine. It is important to refer that there is a different bind mechanism for each interface type. The reference bind mechanism shown in our previous example will create an in-pod bridge for each interface, along with a tap device for the VM, both of which they will configure accordingly. In the example, both the tap device and the pod interface is connected to this in-pod bridge, which effectively extends the pod networking into the future virtual machine. Let's not get into too much detail in this. The main message here is that each binding mechanism does different things, but all of them will create and configure different types of networking infrastructure, which, as we've seen before, is all privileged operations. You must remember that it is actually libvirt that instantiates the virtual machine, an operation that is specified in a domain XML document. Hence, one of the steps involved in the networking configuration for the virtual machine is translating from the kubevirt virtual machine specification to a libvirt DOM-XML document. This short example shows parts of both, focusing on the network-related entities. In the left, you can see that we are requesting a VM with two interfaces, one of type bridge, another of type masquerade. The second part of the bind mechanism will perform this translation from the kubevirt specification into a domain XML document, which will finally be fed to libvirt. Libvirt, in turn, will transform that XML document into a sequence of parameters for QEMU, the architectural element responsible for running the VM. There are two main takeaways from this architecture section. The first is that kubevirt has two types of components: a trusted component, which is kubevirt's agent in each of the nodes, and an untrusted component that will execute the user's VMs and as such run third-party code. The other takeaway is that network configuration occurs in two different stages. One that requires privileged operations, since it is creating and configuring network infrastructure, and another stage that only features unprivileged operations, because it is mainly translating from kubevirt spec into libvirt's DOM-XML. Now that we have a clear picture of kubevirt's process architecture and how networking is configured for the virtual machines, we can describe what is our motivation, problem, and goals. The motivation should be pretty clear by now. We want to reduce the overall attack surface of the solution in a way that if a malicious user manages to compromise the untrusted components of the architecture, the potential damage to the system is not severe. With this in mind, the problem can be clearly defined. An untrusted component of the architecture is executing privileged operations, and as such, the whole component is being granted more capabilities than what it should have. Finally, our goals, despite somewhat complex, are straightforward. We want to remove both the netadmin and the netraw capabilities from the untrusted component of the architecture. In order to allow the aforementioned capabilities to be dropped, we had first to split the network configuration, making sure that all the privileged operations are executed in the trusted component. Let's see how that was possible. Originally, the prepare pod networking stage was executed on the untrusted component. It would create the in-pod bridge, configure it, and connect it to the pod interface. All of these are privileged operations, and as such, should now be relocated to the trusted component of the architecture. After that, on a later stage, kubevirt would translate the kubevirt VM specification into a libvirt DOM-XML, which would be used to instantiate a running virtual machine. The solution is to move these privileged operations to the trusted component, but execute them in the untrusted component's network namespace. To do that, we need to use the untrusted process PID to load its network namespace. This activated rectangle in the right represents just that, despite the fact that the prepare pod networking calls are now executed in the trusted component, it happens in the untrusted process network namespace. The second stage of VM network configuration will still be executed in the untrusted process, which is perfectly fine since it does not require any particular set of capabilities. You can find in this slide both the kubevirt issue and the pull request where this work was implemented. In this section of the presentation, I will explain how we have refactored KubeVirt's code in order to remove the net raw capability from the untrusted components of the process architecture. If you remember the demos I've shown previously in the introduction section, you would remember I showed two tasks that required the net raw capability. The first, open a raw socket. The second, setting the SO bind to device socket option. While our codebase did not use raw sockets, our DHCP server implementation that dynamically configures VM IP addresses was using this option. As such, we had to find an alternative way of filtering data from this interface and limit writing to it. You can find the pull request that implemented this feature in KubeVirt referenced in the slide. To have a proper understanding of the performed refactor, we should first understand what was the initial status quo. Originally, our in-pod DHCP server was creating a datagram socket, and it would afterwards set the SO bind to device socket option in it, which would then drop all the received traffic from interfaces other than the one requested. In this short example, let us consider we want to bind to interface number 2. Finally, we would then bind the socket to an address. In this case, it would be port 67, which is the DHCP server's listening port. For this NetRAW related refactor, the idea is to manually filter incoming traffic by the interface index. In order for that to happen, the in-pod DHCP server creates a datagram socket. It would then directly bind the socket to DHCP server port, which is still port 67. This step would leave the socket listening to all the interfaces in the pod. An outgoing interface selection would happen based on the kernel routing table. This is far from what we require. To preserve the whole behavior, we need to listen only to a particular interface and to send the DHCP replies via that very same interface. To enable that, we first need to ask the kernel to decorate the incoming packets with the interface index from which they were received on. Afterwards, whenever we receive a packet via the socket, we can compare the interface from which the packet came from with the interface we are interested on. All traffic originating from an interface that we are not interested in will be silently dropped at the application level. Finally, we reply back to the sender, indicating the interface we want to send the packet to via Linux control messages. In this next section, I will focus on the work done to enable the netadmin capability to be removed from the untrusted component pod specification. Let's begin by enumerating the calls that are executed to configure the networks for our virtual machines that do require the netadmin capability. Those are creating and configuring the tap device, creating the in-pod bridge, connect the tap device to the in-pod bridge, depending on the bind mechanism, connect the pod interface to the in-pod bridge, and finally, configure the in-pod bridge. I am breaking down the in-pod bridge configuration part in two different tasks for a simple reason. Part of this was already performed when we split the network configuration to occur in two different stages. Configuring the MAC and MTU of the bridge was already addressed and explained. However, we had left out this small configuration detail. We had yet to move disabling the offloading of the transmit checksum from the untrusted component to the trusted component. This operation uses an IOCDL that requires the netadmin capability. As such, and once that was done, we were missing two tasks. The first, create and configure the tap device on behalf of libvirt, and the second, connect the tap device to the in-pod bridge, which obviously requires the tap device to have been created previously. You must remember that it was originally libvirt, which is running in the untrusted component, that was creating the tap device, and that creating a virtual interface is an operation that does require the netadmin capability. Again, the solution was to move the tap device creation from the untrusted component to the trusted one, and then indicate libvirt that it should use a pre-existing tap device instead of creating a new one. For this last step to happen, we required libvirt to learn a new trick. It had to consume pre-configured tap devices without touching their configuration. Furthermore, our untrusted component domain XML generation mechanism, the part of the bind mechanism that translates from kubevirt language to libvirt language, had to be updated to use the new API libvirt kindly provided for us. Before this change, kubevirt translated the user-provided specification to an interface type bridge, which would task it with creating a new tap device and attach the tap device to the bridge specified in the target element. Libvirt already had an Ethernet type, through which it would create and configure a new tap device, which would in turn allow the virtual machine to have an emulated network device. Upon learning of our requirement, the libvirt team introduced a new managed parameter to the target element. If a non-managed, already existing target is requested, no further configuration is performed, which allows the pre-configured tap device to be imported by libvirt without having the netadmin capability. There is a tiny nuance to this. This capability is not needed only if the tap creator and the tap consumer user and group IDs match. This gives kubevirt the ability to consume a pre-configured tap device. But for that to happen, the tap device must be created and configured beforehand. In this step, we have had, akin to what I have shown previously for the bridge, to create a tap device on the trusted component on behalf of the untrusted component. For it, we had to use the untrusted process PID to tap into the untrusted component network namespace, so the tap device is available for when libvirt attempts to consume it. It was somewhat trickier than when creating the bridge, since SU Linux frowned upon our plan. Despite creating the tap on the untrusted component network namespace, it is created by the trusted component, and as such, the tap device internal structure, which is the TUN socket, is inheriting the SU Linux context from its creator. In this case, it received the super privileged type context. When libvirt, which runs using the SU Linux context of the untrusted component, attempts to consume the existing tap, SU Linux prevents it, since the context of the resource, the TUN socket, and the context of the process accessing the resource do not match. To appease SU Linux, we have had to create the tap device with the untrusted component SU Linux context, which is something the super privileged pod has access to. You can find below in this short code snippet how the privileged pod accesses the SU Linux context of another process. Now that kubevirt's trusted component is able to successfully create the tap device in the network namespace of the untrusted component using the correct SU Linux context, all that was left to do was to update the translation mechanism between the kubevirt specification language to kubevirt's DOM XML to use the new API that libvirt has provided for us. Removing the netadmin capability from the untrusted component pod is pending a single leftover. When libvirt is instructed to import a pre-configured, pre-existing tap device via the manage equals no parameter in the target element, but also instructed to configure the guest MTU via the MTU element, it should not configure the tap site and perform only MTU configuration of the emulated device present within the virtual machine. Remember that updating the MTU of virtual interface does require the netadmin capability. This is tracked in the bug mentioned below and was patched upstream mid-January. Kubevirt will update to this version of libvirt as soon as possible. Let's finalize this presentation with a list of next steps to be done. As I've just mentioned, we need to wait for the bug that I've mentioned previously about the MTU on libvirt to be released. Like the fix is already merged upstream and we just need to wait for it to be available on an upstream distribution. Once we have that, we'll update the liver version with this new patched version. And with that, we can finally remove the capnet admin from the vert launcher, which is the untrusted component pod template, by reverting this commit right here. And this is all. Thank you very much for your time. I hope you had some fun and learned something, and I'm now available for some questions. Thank you again.